You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We light this chalice for the web of life which sustains us, for the sacred circle of life in which we have our being, for the land, the oceans, the sky, above and below us, and for our Mother Earth, and for the deep and infinite mystery that holds it all. Well, good morning and welcome to our service of worship. We call it a service because it's meant to serve you. And we call it worship because it raises to worth things that matter. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church, and I welcome you on behalf of generations of Unitarians who have worshiped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. This is a spiritual community, a community that supports you in finding, fashioning, and following your own spiritual path, any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. Please do join us after the service for coffee, tea, and conversation. Let's begin by singing our opening hymn, Wake Now My Senses.
Nature is not a boundless ocean of resources, and the actions we perform have an effect on the world around us. In the theory of karma, the effects of our actions are in proportion to the greed and hatred which motivated them. So if our spoiling of the planet through stripping its resources and polluting it was motivated by greed, we are now beginning to experience the effects of that greed. The earth is our mirror. We are the generation with the awareness of a great danger. We are the ones with the responsibility and ability to take steps of concrete action before it is too late.
The Gates of Hope. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, not the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges. People cannot hear us there, they cannot pass through. Nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything's going to be all right. But a different, sometimes lonely place, the place of truth-telling. About your own soul, first of all, and its condition. The place of resistance and defiance. The piece of ground from which you can see the world, both as it is, and as it could be, as it will be, the place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but the joy of struggle. And we stand there, beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing, asking people what they see.
That lovely reading John just did, The Gates of Hope, is by my colleague, Reverend Victoria Safford, one of our movement's very best preachers in the prophetic tradition. It's the preface to a new book coming out of the UUA called After the Good News, Progressive Faith Beyond Optimism by Nancy MacDonald Ladd. And it is well, the most bracing, vivifying thing to come out of our movement in years, this book. It's the voice of younger UU ministers who are interested in how we do church with authenticity and truth-telling, now that last century's assurances of endless progress toward common goals rings false during what we know to be the sixth mass extinction event that climate change is causing, rising wealth inequality, and brutal authoritarianism. It is a needful adjustment that we Unitarians must make in our movement, lest we come across feebly Pollyanna-ish in our largely privileged comfort. So my apologies to you in advance if you were hoping for a barrel of laughs today. Sometimes you just have to save dessert for later and eat your vegetables. But at least we'll be eating them together. Don't mistake that book and this talk for doomsday preaching. I have never been a fan of doomsday preaching. The idea of doomsday itself has a long and unhelpful history in the Abrahamic traditions and in Western culture generally, like some self-loathing masochistic fantasy. And there's always been prophesying about the end of days when the wrath of God gets visited upon us and we finally reap cosmic justice for what we've sown. But historically, when the influence of Abrahamic religions began to wane with the coming of the Industrial Age, doomsday from heaven was replaced by a more earthly doomsday, the mass destructive power of industrial-scale world wars. About the same time, one was going, the other was coming in. And as the second industrial-scale world war came to an end, its piecemeal mass destruction was handily replaced by global nuclear mutually assured destruction of the nuclear winter. But again, as time moved on, after this nuclear standoff between East and West de-escalated somewhat, doomsday was resurrected as global warming and climate change about one generation ago. So there's always been a handy doom around to frighten people with, get self-righteous about, and spout predictions about the fall of mighty cities, the drying up of seas, and the scorched and desolate wasteland earth that awaits us as karma for our own folly. So doomsday preaching for me is just too easy. It's fish in a barrel to galvanize any group by fear, that basest of emotions, and in so doing paint yourself as the brave one who's calling it out. What escapes notice in all that fear-mongering is that the prophet of doom is just as implicated in the sins that lead to whatever doomsday awaits and is every bit as doomed as anyone else. But doomsday prophecy does reveal something true. That we are deeply aware that our life on this earth has always been vulnerable. Our human progress means we're always living in times that are strange and therefore threatening to us. It's just that the kind of strangeness and the kind of threat keeps changing. And it's easy, of course, to look back and see what we've done wrong. It is a whole lot harder to look ahead and see what we ought to do, and whether we should even bother to do anything, especially if we're all doomed. There's a poem by Shelley, Ozymandias, that's famous for nailing both our fragility and the simple ironic fact that given time, all the things we build and strive for will indeed fall apart, even us. While traveling in Egypt, Shelley sees this inscription on a base of a huge broken statue of a pharaoh, once mighty. And the inscription says, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, you mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." It's always the more spectacular fallings that get our attention, of course. To many people, and I'm sure many of you here, the burning of Notre Dame Cathedral last fortnight seemed to go beyond mere damage to a heritage landmark that only needs money to be rebuilt, and more a sort of death of Princess Di moment, you know, a globalized wave of devastation and grief. As the burning spire spectacularly toppled, it was being live-streamed by many witnesses on the YouTube platform, and something really telling happened with this. As they were live-streaming it, the algorithm that throws up a list of similar things you might like to look at if you're looking at this suggested videos of this. The 9/11 towers falling, So the global brain, called the internet, saw these two falling towers as the same thing, more or less. And in a way, they are. Falling towers are motivating, not just because they're spectacle. Falling towers have a mythic dimension, and thus mass psychological power. And that is why a broken tower is a major tarot symbol. Tarot symbols, remember, didn't just happen, but emerged in Western culture as expressions of deep psychological and archetypal significance. The broken tower symbolizes sudden change and destruction, but also the getting of wisdom and liberation. The falling tower is both crisis and opportunity. It recalls this image, the ancient stories of the fall of the Tower of Babel and the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, and faced with the collapse of mighty human edifices, we, poor souls, are reminded of the precariousness of our lives, and we seek comfort and communion in renewed assertions of order, civil order, militaristic order, artistic order. A little perspective can help us put any crisis in a new and better order and can lead us to comfort, maybe even to wisdom. Let me give you an example of what I mean. During the same week as the Notre Dame fire, three black churches in the St. Landry Parish in Louisiana were also burned to the ground in a white supremacist hate crime. No, they're not Notre Dame. They're actual working churches. Notre Dame stopped primarily being a place of worship ages ago and is, in fact, a museum diorama, a major tourism generator for Paris and a PR outlet for the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. But to the St. Landry Parish, these churches gave their people's less spectacular world order and meaning and hope. These three churches weren't repositories of major artistic and architectural achievements, but then this parish and these three churches were poor, a legacy of U.S. slavery, whereas the French Catholic Church and the hereditary kings of France and its military emperors who have owned Notre Dame were never once poor, but soaked in riches wrung from subjugated races since the Crusades, since colonialism, and since their slave trade. Now, if you feel for one church and not the others, you're probably A, white, and B, not sufficiently critical of the information source you consume, 80% of which comes from this guy and serves his interests. It's not that we're looking at the wrong tragedies. The Notre Dame fire is certainly to be regretted. We're just not seeing the fuller picture. And in our purposely narrowed view, we come to value certain things and disregard other things, when in fact, both things are of value. We gasp at the burning of Notre Dame, for instance, but not at the destruction of the Islamic architectural wonders of Aleppo in Syria, like this, and this, and this. Aleppo, which, by the way, France enthusiastically participated in destroying. We feel gut-punched by the fall of the Twin Towers in New York, but not the willful destruction of the irreplaceable Buddhist statues of Afghanistan. Their name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Billions of public and private dollars are being rallied to rebuild something owned by the world's largest and richest private landholding organization, the Catholic Church, rich enough, by the way, to rebuild 100 Notre Dames if they wanted to. The staggering capital flow is not to restore lives lost. There were no lives lost. By contrast, the Grenfell Tower fire in London, in which 72 poor brown Londoners died, has only managed to raise $2.8 million over a couple of years to compensate hundreds of surviving victims so far. I mean, if the Catholics were looking for something to do with their money, they might remember that Jesus cared more about people than stained glass and architecture. So for us, rather than throwing money at a rich multinational cult-damaged showpiece, we might, closer to home, consider preserving this, the Burrup rock art, which is older than the last ice age, and under constant but preventable threat of destruction by WA's mining industries. It's funny this, we watch Notre Dame fall, and in doing that, we look at something that took centuries to develop, which can never be entirely recreated, which disappears in the blink of an eye. And such is the effect of spectacle and where we're made to look, and the cultural values from what we regularly look at. But instead, what we're not seeing as much, and thus not sufficiently valuing, are other things disappearing more slowly and less spectacularly. Glaciers, coastlines, forests, whole species that took not centuries, but eons to develop and which can never, ever be entirely recreated. In the lifetime of some of the youngest members here, half of the world's wildlife has been wiped off the face of the earth. Half. Including this guy, just last week, we have seen the last of the Yangtze yellow turtle. 900 years for a cathedral? That's 600 million years. You don't have to be a granola-crunching greenie to accept that biodiversity is crucial to all life on this planet, including ours. To be alive and aware of such things in the 21st century may infect us with a sort of sense of impotence and fatalism that living in end times has always felt like. And the spectacle of falling towers serves to distract us from a doomsday vastly more real and threatening, but just out of the frame. And not just out of the frame, but put intentionally out of the frame by those with the wealth to shape media and public policy for their own ends. What can we do about this? This brings me to why our church has a Stop Adani sign out front. Perhaps the hardest of our principles to bring into frame and focus is the seventh, the interdependent web of being of which we are a part. That's the one traveling around the circle and binding it. The web is not visible, it's a metaphor, but scientifically verifiable in terms of the air we all breathe, the fresh water all life needs, the biodiverse sphere that sustains us, and its climate and ecosystems which don't respect boundaries. Humans are formed by and deeply interpenetrated with larger systems we did not create and cannot make. Earth was given to us as a garden, and we can ruin it. Now, for us, many Unitarians around the world remain confused, though, in seeking to practice the principles we preach when our advocacy for climate justice begins to look like political action. They're not wrong to be confused. How can a free church remain free if it takes a corporate stand on climate justice? How do we live the seventh or any principle, remain relevant and engaged in the world, and keep our integrity as one free church when there will always be many views among free people about justice and how it's pursued? Well, today, I hope to put an end to the crippling stasis of this confusion. For it is not true to say that our church, like many others, takes no stance on matters of justice. First of all, being above and apart from ecological and social systems is a metaphysical impossibility. That's just a fact. We're bound up. Our church, like many, has often denied our enmeshment in larger systems by assuming a kind of invisible political stance, a default political stance, called quietism. Quietism, despite the soft and cushy feeling of that name, is actually a source of oppression. It effectively gags a church from taking any stance on things that matter. Quietism serves the interests of internal harmony and comfortable civility within the church itself. Quietism neuters churches with the banal observation that not everyone thinks the same way. As if any group of people ever thinks exactly the same way. I mean, even Quakers will tell you that their consensus politics always means someone is coerced into gagging themselves for peace within the fellowship. In quietism, we choose not to publicly proclaim our values. We choose not to think out loud at all. So quietism is a type of passive-aggressive coercion, and coercion is the opposite of freedom. Who says peace and harmony and civility inside one's little fellowship is the greatest good and must never be threatened? But is it wise to replace the subtle coercion of quietism with the more strident coercion of activism? You may be surprised to know that there is a third way out of this unhelpful binary for free churches and is in fact what we are practicing. Both quietism and activism spring from theological heresies. You wouldn't be surprised to know this has a theological side. I'm a theologian. In activism, the slow and invisible work of the Spirit is pushed out of frame by human effort. Activism can thus be a creed of the self-righteous who need no divine assistance to achieve a better world. Any notion of grace is scorned as a crutch for the weak. The activist says the Spirit is not needed. Confident in their own moral strength, the activists can lift themselves up by their own bootstraps. Now, this activism may look like people exercising existential freedom, but it can also be coercive in its assertive righteousness. However, exercising activism does not put anyone less active beyond fellowship in a truly free church. Now, the quietist position is the more theistic. In quietism, any human struggle is made irrelevant by divine processes working automatically. God alone is responsible for peace, justice, and betterment of the world. The creed of the quietist is, let go and let God. No human struggle is necessary. No resistance to redemption, no resistance to temptation or sin is required, and we don't need to examine our own complicity in bigger systems because God's work's at it, and God's work's not our own. Justice and progress are in His hands. Quietism best suits those who see their lives as unaffected by social injustice, saying, I've got mine, so don't belabor me with the fact that you don't. Although we might find the self-seeking of quietism irritating, we are still a free church. So quietism in matters of social justice does not put the more active members beyond fellowship. Both quietism and activism, then, are legitimate spiritual paths. Some people gain spiritual growth and vibrancy from a retreat from the world into the self. Some gain spiritual growth and vibrancy for active engagement in matters of public ethics. As a free church, we individuals in it are free to align ourselves as the Spirit moves us. Some of us are quietists, some of us are activists. The activism of the active does not remove quietists' freedom to be quiet, but neither should quietism stifle activism and be our one and only default stance as a church towards things that matter. So, the only corporate approach to social justice in a free church, such as ours, has to be a way that lifts up our freedom to find, fashion, and follow whatever spiritual path works for us. This middle road between corporate activism and corporate quietism is voluntarism, which is based in the will, the free will. We should be free to speak out from our church principles against things that oppress, enslave, or destroy life, and to try to educate others about why we think this is so. But in so doing, we do not demand that everyone in the church fall into lockstep and do likewise. We have a Stop Adani sign out front because several free members felt sufficiently strongly about climate change to take up the ARRCC's invitation to be part of its nationwide church effort to affirm climate justice as a religious value. All religions speak with one voice about our relationship to the planet as one of stewardship, not piracy. If you are not personally happy with how that sign aligns with our seventh principle, you are free to put a barrow of coal out on the forecourt and stick a sign in it saying, coal is great. Now, you don't tend to see people doing that because coal doesn't lack boosters, does it? Coal and fossil fuels have plenty of loud and effective and well-paid advocates in the public sphere. Reinhardt, Murdoch, both major parties, and probably some of your shares and pension funds to argue its case. But if you want to advocate for more coal, no one in this place will stop you. But then, you would voluntarily cease to be a quietist and become an activist, wouldn't you? Sucked in. Personally, theologically, I prefer the spiritual path of quietism, except that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, so I am activist enough to want to find a way to end this fossil fuel aggression against me and mine and yours. Now look, I am all for God's arc of history bending towards justice eventually, someday, in sweet by and by, but I see no problem with giving that arc a good hard shove once in a while. I don't do doomsday preaching because it's just words, but action, action, I can get behind. And I think a sign is like the least we can do. Will stopping Adani stop climate change all by itself? No. Adani, like a falling tower, is a symbol, a way of saying, this is the end, no more. Even coal by itself isn't enough. It's a symbol of a need to rethink and restructure carbon-based industrial capitalism and valuing its endless GDP growth as the only metric of worth. If Adani falls, though, its falling will be a powerful symbol of a bigger perspective shift. Symbols can be powerful because they shape our perspective. They shape the way we see the world. David Suzuki says that the way we see the world shapes the way we treat it. These are his words. If a mountain is a deity, not a pile of ore, if a river is one of the veins of the land, not potential rice irrigation, if a forest is a sacred grove and not lumber, if species are biological kin, not resources, or if the planet is our mother, not an opportunity for a few to get rich, then we will treat the planet and each other with greater respect. This is the challenge, to look at the Earth from a different perspective. This picture of Earthrise, like the Lorax, is half a century old this year. Half a century. That symbol. Its symbolism was powerful in its day and motivated much of today's environmental movement. All reliable science says that we do not have another 50 years to protect the Mother Earth that gives us life, and it also tells us that it is not yet too late. If good people, people acting from their deep principles, people like you, are not quiet. Amen. Let our mission be to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the gates of blithe optimism, not the gates of common sense, not the gates of self-righteousness, nor denial, nor power itself. Let our mission as free souls be a place of truth-telling, without fear, without favor. Amen. Have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.